this book on Hegel that we've been talking about, Todd McGowan's book, Emancipation After Hegel, basically shows you've got to be a Christian to be a communist. So, sorry.
Do you ever read the Zizek thing on St. Paul? I never read the actual, not just the bits of references to it, but the actual book that he wrote on that. I never did.
The best thing that I saw on this was a tweet where somebody was like, yeah, basically Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens made being an atheist so uncool that all the Marxists have now become religious. And they're citing St. Paul and Hegel and Zizek, but it's really just they don't want to be a logic bro.
Yeah. No, but the point that Zizek makes, I think, which he gets from Hegel, is that God himself is inconsistent and divided. And I never, I never really understood its significance until I read the McGowan book, because the point being that it's one thing to say God doesn't exist, because at the same time you still kind of posit the absence of some all-powerful, pervasive, mysterious entity whose will can't be known. You just deny that it exists in this particular kind of supernatural context. Whereas if you say that, if you don't say that God, if you say God doesn't exist, not only does God not exist, but God is also inconsistent and divided and confused within himself, which according to Zizek is the kind of logic of Christianity, then it's a much more radical subversion of the premise of religion than simply saying that God doesn't exist, which is, the kind of Enlightenment shtick. And because it only really became clear to me with McGowan.
It's a bit like the correlate would be like, not only should like, the capitalists not rule, but it's that they're not fit to rule, I guess,
Yes,
I guess
that's the correlate. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Not only should they not, but also they're incapable of realizing the benefits of capitalism itself, in fact.
Yeah. Should we go?
should we actually turn to the material?
Hey there, dear patrons. This is what we're calling an after party. We're going to have a little discussion amongst ourselves, myself, Alex, George, and Phil. That's not four of us. I'm Alex. Anyway, about what we've just discussed with Krithika. The book's really interesting and enlightened me personally as to the way the Saudis have operated around the world. And especially this notion that it was, reached its kind of peak in the pre-9/11 period, and then they had to kind of hunker down. I mention that because we're recording this on the 14th of May, and yesterday it was reported that the U.S. had inadvertently released the main Saudi contact for the 9/11 bombers. And I'm just going to read a quote here from a spokesman for the 9/11 families. This shows that there is a complete government cover-up of the Saudi involvement. It demonstrates that there was a hierarchy of command that's coming from the Saudi embassy to the Ministry of Islamic Affairs in Los Angeles to the hijackers. So that obviously sounds quite damning. I haven't read the report or what's come out about it, but it is quite striking and does kind of throw you back to those days in kind of the early 2000s and the beginning of the war on terror and how insane the U.S. relations with Saudi were and continue to be.
Yeah. The thing that strikes me the most about it, like you say, it kind of brings back all of that stuff. And I mean, to be clear, I mean, I'm sure the terror attacks, the Al-Qaeda terror attacks weren't ordered from the upper echelons of the Saudi regime, but that the Al-Qaeda itself, as part of the outgrowth of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, was so deeply intertwined with the US state, so deeply intertwined with Saudi intelligence and security services and all of the weird covert transnational structures that they had set up to funnel Mujahideen and jihadists to their favored battle sites of the Cold War and post-Cold War era, as Krithika mentioned, like in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Chechnya as well, which we didn't talk about, but that it's unsurprising that there were handlers, effectively, it seems, as a result of this information that's just been released accidentally by the FBI, that the hijackers had Saudi intelligence handlers. It's one thing that It's a point, in fact, that I made recently elsewhere. But the story of the story of the of this alliance between the US and Islamism and jihadism in the Cold War and post-Cold War period. It's so convoluted, it's so paradoxical, it's so strange, and it involves so many flips and kind of striking paradoxes and reversals that it would only really, it requires a kind of Chestertonian fable to do it justice. So I'm thinking of J.K. Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday, which is a this wonderful fable of anarchist terrorism in the late 19th century. Where in fact it turns out, and I'm not giving anything away, but
everyone's
in the story, yeah, essentially everyone who's an anarchist terrorist in the novel turns out to be a secret agent who's been sent to penetrate the anarchist secret cell. But there are no, there's no anarchist secret cell to penetrate because everyone is actually working for the state. And it's a similar thing with the, it's a similar thing with Al Qaeda and the Mujahideen, and I think cosmopolitan jihadism in general. It's
maybe
so,
with leftist podcasts as well.
It's so interpenetrated. It's so interpenetrated with the, this is a serious point though, but it's so interpenetrated with the US state that it's impossible to tell where the US state begins or ends rather, and where some kind of authentic, you know, Muslim jihadi uprising, anti-imperial insurrection begins. You know, it's impossible to tell between the two because,
and applies
so
elsewhere as well, right? I mean, you know, the Israelis being responsible for getting Hamas off the ground as well as a counter to the secular liberation movement.
I mean, I think I think that because at the core of the relationship with the cosmopolitan jihad is the Saudi, so the US-Saudi axis, which is much stronger than the connection between Israel and Hamas. And I think, and to some extent, you know, Hamas is kind of a byproduct of the US-Saudi stimulus to cosmopolitan jihadism. So, I mean, just to illustrate, because, what you know, so you have the Mujahideen, the support for the anti-Soviet Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 80s, which is protracted and extended into support for Mujahideen in the civil war in Bosnia, where they become effectively the armed wing of the humanitarian liberal opinion of the day. Support for jihadi support for the war in Chechnya, which is a good way to tangle with the Russians supporting ethnic secessionism in the Russian periphery, to support then for Islamist support for Kosovo's Albanian separatism in 1999. And then suddenly it all goes the other way with the terror attacks of 2001. And the alliance seems to be broken. And then, you know, you kind of dial forward a couple of decades, and we're into the Syrian civil war, and suddenly the alliance is reformed. They're supporting Saudi and Qatari backed militias. The US and the CIA are providing special forces and pumping literally millions and millions of dollars worth of armaments to Islamist militias and Al-Qaeda affiliated militias in Syria. And it's just, it's so bizarre and convoluted, like I say, that you can't really account for it in terms that are geopolitical or would fit into some kind of pragmatic, sensible calculus of rational geopolitical calculation or power politics. It could only be done justice, like I say, by a kind of Chestertonian fable.
And I guess one of the... Sorry, go on, Alex.
Well, no, I mean, it's funny just casting your mind back to the kind of 2000, to the early 2000s. I mean, right, you know, I wasn't an adult at the time of the 9/11 attacks. And at the time, I think there was obviously the whole kind of the kind of polarization, at least from kind of a left-wing point of view, was like, oh, the U.S. state and kind of Muslim countries, and the U.S. is going to war with, you know, some backward, one of the poorest countries in the world. How outrageous and whatever. But I think, at least myself, I wasn't properly attuned to how interlinked the U.S. state, the U.S. military establishment, the security state was with jihadism, you know? And
it's still one of the most, I mean, it's still one of the most astonishing stories of modern times, because, you know, essentially what it is, right, with Osama bin Laden, it's a CIA agent goes rogue and attacks his handlers. If you'd given that story to if you'd given that story to a Hollywood producer, they would have kicked it back for being too cliched. And it turned out to be reality. You know, a CIA agent goes rogue and he has to be hunted down by the forces of the US state.
And it's completely ridiculous. And to make a callback to an episode two episodes ago or whatever. No, it was a little bit longer than that. But, you know, this is a kind of tail end of anti-communism still as well. Right. I mean, it's supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan under the guise of anti-communism and its continuation through this period as well.
It's one of the most important stories, I think, to draw out from the discussion with Kritika, but also more generally, as we had a few episodes back in our discussion with Vincent and the anti-communist massacres in the 60s in Indonesia. That Islamism has played a vital role in suppressing the forces of secularism, of secular modernist nationalist and communist emancipation in the 20th century, and that we live in the aftermath of that and with the overhang of that, which is the widespread influence of Salafist Islamism, as Kritika said towards the end of the chat with her, is the fact that it's become entrenched around the world.
Yeah, I guess this was kind of one of my questions, linking this particularly to the episode with Vincent, whether a lot of this story is is essentially, I guess, the echoes or the hangover of that Cold War, that the anti-communism gave it the impetus, gave it the momentum, the first push, and then this is essentially some of the forms that kind of that anti-communism took. Or these networks and these kind of, you know, mazes and labyrinths that the money goes through from here to there. But I mean, that was my question, is essentially whether this is, I guess, continuous with that story of anti-communism. That's the real kind of political origin.
I mean, if you look at kind of the anti-communism and the way that it installs conservative nationalists around the globe, I think that tendency is already there, and it becomes worse after the end of the Cold War, when there's the kind of, because you don't have the kind of set piece of two competing secular ideologies, that you have a kind of return and you know, in an uncertain and an unsafe world, in various different countries, especially, you know, kind of outside of the Western bubble, countries looking to religious tradition, ethnic traditionalism, whatever it might be, for a
basis
to create.
But it's very specific in the Muslim world. It is conservative Islam is a bulwark of the recreation of an identity that is conservative, allied with the US in various ways, and also opposed to the secular ideals of emancipation associated with the left, associated with anti-imperial nationalism, associated with modernization, associated with communism and with socialism. The other thing I would add, though, is also, this is kind of an anecdote, but an insight from growing up in the Middle East, is how American the Gulf states are. And it struck me so I didn't grow up in Saudi Arabia. I grew up in Oman, which is it borders with Yemen and is just on the edge of the Arabian Peninsula on the southeast corner of Saudi Arabia. But one thing that she said in Saudi is noting when she visits Saudi how Americanized it seems, with all the McDonald's and all the American, you know, the brands and so on. And it's very similar throughout the Gulf, in the Emirates, in Oman, in Qatar, Kuwait and Bahrain. It's intensely Americanized. And so it struck me, this only came to me obviously after having left the region, but it struck me how much, in a way, the deeply religious and conservative aspect of those societies, it's like an American evangelical utopia,
except that
it's Muslim. So, you know, it's very American in the sense, like, you have these decentralized car-based cities. It's all based around oil, you know, like Texas. It has it's so many American brands, American chains that you don't get even in Western Europe, or are less prominent in Western Europe. It's so the Saudi channels, the satellite TV channels, which we used to get when I was growing up when I was there in Oman, are all American TV shows, in which the sex scenes have been cut out, so they skip them over. So it's this astonishing, the culture is so Americanized, except given a kind of Muslim twist. And It's so remarkable. It has to be experienced to be believed.
No, and the comparison to evangelicals is correct, because, you know, there's a whole worship of wealth, and, you know, American evangelicals tend to be relatively better off, and not to say that they're all exceptionally well off, but
but it's built around the cult of kind of worldly success. It vindicates the religion, and there's an element of that too. So it's tremendously Americanized, and I suppose that's what I want to put across. And that's the undergirds the geopolitical security alliance between Islamism and U.S. imperial interests.
So culturally, there's the figure of the shopping mall in both contexts. I guess the air-conditioned place of consumption. My experience of Dubai just being in the airport a number of times,
and in Brazil for that matter as well. I mean, you know, especially not so much maybe in kind of the center of big cities, but, you know,
yeah, but Brazil is America. Brazil is in America. My point, it's, you know, this well, is but what no, I'm trying but, to but, cut but, against. But, no, but what I'm trying it's to cut a little against bit of an aside. Is the no, idea no, no, that I... there is some authentic, deep Islamic, you know, ancient heritage and tradition which
absolutely.
Is being called
it's...
upon. Whereas, you know, Brazil is the new world, whereas Arabia is genuinely very much the old world. But modern Arabia is just
but there's a point here. There's a point here at which Krithika rightly makes out. The Saudi state is only 70, maybe 90 years old now, right? So it's not as if it's an old society where there's this continuous national identity over 300 years something. Sure. So
what I'm saying is, though, from the outside, it's often portrayed still, you know, continuously in the West. Islam is portrayed as something which has such these deep and ancient roots. You know, it's understood kind of similar depth to historical Christianity. There's the kind of ancient clash between Islam and Europe with the Crusades and so on. And all of that, I think, is phony. It's a completely phony depth.
It's like Thomas Friedman bullshit, right? The Lexus and the olive tree and all that.
Yeah, it's a mirage, because any familiarity with the modern character of those societies, like I say, the kind of Californian-style sprawling cities, the oil wealth, the prominence of religion in public life, which an Christian evangelical in the States could only dream of, all of that is so intensely American. It can't be anything else but American, except that it's, you know, everyone is Arabic and it's Islam rather than Christianity.
I think India provides a good point of comparison here, though, because it's a similarly, you know, recent state which draws on this kind of mythical idea of unity in that case, and diversity, but religion obviously being a part of that, but doesn't have that same, I guess, that same religiosity projected externally. I think it's I haven't been to Saudi Arabia. I don't know if the discussion made me want to go.
George, did you say India doesn't project its religiosity? I mean,
not in the same way as
not as an international.
It doesn't have an
project.
Outreach program.
Yeah, yeah.
In the way that the Krithika describes in her book. But yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's because you have obviously Hindu nationalism now, and, you know, carrying out kind of pogroms.
Yeah, it's not evangelical there.
No.
There's no call, and there's the fetishization of some ancient depth, indigenous depth to the religion, but, you know, nonetheless, there is no projection outwards the way that there is with Saudi, which was the whole point of Krithika's book, but anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one maybe thing I wanted to take away or tease out from the discussion, I think, because I think there's an element to which the Saudis are treated, you know, kind of exoticized, and it's like, you know, they're just motivated by this religious project, and it just so happens that they're sitting on a bunch of oil, which has allowed them to carry this through. But I mean, you know, that isn't exactly the case. As, you know, she says in the book, there's always been an uneasy relationship between, or, you know, not an uneasy relationship maybe, but one that has had to be, a relationship that's had to be managed between the royal family on the one hand and the Wahhabi preachers and scholars and so on, the kind of religious establishment. And I think maybe at some point...
It's religious justification, religious legitimacy for a state. I think that is a really good point that you're making. Sorry, I kind of interrupt you to tell you.
No,
what,
you go
you
on.
But no, that it's political. It's there's a political dimension to it. So you're right. The kind of stereotype. It's all about religion and oil. It's right to reject that if anybody does hold that sort of stereotyped naive view.
So I think maybe we can leave this there. This has just been a short little after party kind of post interview discussion to tease out some extra things that we maybe didn't get to say during the interview. But we should be back with something more on this, because I definitely think we should do more on kind of what happened to secularism, because it's maybe not often discussed enough, but especially outside of Europe and, you know, arguably outside of North America as well. It's a real factor. And, you know, I mean, living in Brazil, having to face the rise of evangelism, it's pretty striking and depressing development. The secularization thesis and the kind of complacent view that everything's just going to get more secular and religion will just disappear has proven not to be true since the end of the Cold War conflict. All right, that's it for now. Catch you later. Bye-bye.
There's a whole thing about the there's one model of religious proselytism that's basically the more demanding it is, the better. People need rules. They want protection against anime.
I mean, I can kind of buy that. I mean, at least, you know, I rewatched The Young Pope.
We're all speaking from experience here, so.
Because Church of England is not this model.
I meant communism, so, George. Not the
it's not very
Church
demanding. All you have to do is tweet the right things and not be too energy, and you can be a communist. It's actually surprisingly easy.
Oh dear. All right, that was a good joke for a change.
Fucking hell.